It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and you are listening to The Progressive Beat. Welcome to the show. I'm Christy Harvey, and today, my co-host John Neuroer and I will bring you a look at some of the top political issues facing the country, the candidates, and yes, you, the voter. Let's get started. And now it's time for a little paparazzi politics, where John Neuroer and I bring you five stories that maybe you didn't catch on the front page of your newspaper, but you probably still need to know. Story number one. And John, this was a great one from CBS News. This broke over the weekend, actually. In their, basically, their quest to increase offshore drilling, many conservatives and proponents of offshore drilling have decided to use this one phrase to convince people that it's completely safe and there are no environmental dangers.
Okay.
And if you listened to the news or people talking about this at all over the past 2 or 3 weeks, you heard them all say, all these conservatives say, we did not have one drop of oil spilled during Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. For example, Senator Trent Lott from Mississippi came out and said there was not one drop of oil spilled during Hurricane Katrina and Rita. Governor Mike Huckabee came out and said it. The Wall Street Journal editorial page. So basically, all of these people and sites that are pushing to relax the laws against offshore drilling are saying, you know, it's completely safe. Not one drop of oil
there
was spilled.
There has to be some catch to that.
It's not even a catch. This isn't even spin. It's just not true. It's just absolutely, verifiably not true. And I got to tell you, I heard them say it and thought, wow, okay, I believe it. You know, they were just so, they all used the exact same phrases.
Sure.
And they were just so certain about it. But yesterday, CBS News put up on their website that they looked into it. And in 2006, the U.S. Minerals Management Service, or as they say on the inside, MMS, MMS found...
Sick of disease. Oh, I've got the MMS.
MMS found that Hurricanes Katrina and Rita damaged 457 different pipelines and caused 146 different oil spills.
That sounds like a little bit more than a drop.
Well, I think that might be the catch there. They didn't spill one drop. They spilled a lot of drops.
A little bit of a stretch.
A separate study, which was done for MMS just on the environmental impacts of Hurricanes Rita and Katrina, found the exact same thing. They found that 750,000 gallons of petroleum were spilled.
That's a lot.
Into the Gulf of Mexico because of those two hurricanes. And that included about 13,000 barrels of crude oil, just basic crude oil. So to come out and say not a drop of oil was spilled makes absolutely no sense when you can say, oh, really, look at this report. It just makes you have to remember you can't believe it just because they say it on television.
It makes you say, Our second story this week, and this story comes up all the time, I feel like, whenever we get close to an election. But you remember the butterfly ballot in 2000 in Florida that confused all of the people that were trying to punch their ballot, and it looked like it was pointing to one name and it was pointing to another name, and all of a sudden
it was so sad too, because all the old ladies would say, I didn't mean to vote for
Pat Buchanan. Right, yeah. You wouldn't think that they would be, so it was tens of thousands of people that ended up voting for Pat Buchanan in an overly Jewish county in Florida. So after all the problems with the ballots in the last few elections, both midterm and the general elections, the Congress set aside $3 billion to overhaul the voting system. And
$3 billion, like with a B?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, apparently. It takes a lot of money. Not only that, the money wasn't just going to overhaul the system, but first to sort of study it. So a study came out recently from the Brennan Center for Justice, which is at NYU School of Law, that basically says that, we still have these huge problems with the ballots, even after going to electronic voting machines in a lot of places that were supposedly going to fix the problem. And they said that another big problem is that coming up in 2008, there are 11 states, and that's it accounts for 15 million potential voters in these states, that are going to have new machines that haven't been tested yet. So we don't even know if these machines actually are going to work.
They're just
going to
wing it in 2008 election.
Apparently so. And So, you know, we've spent $2 billion of the $3 billion both studying the problem and then trying to implement systems to fix the problem. And the study that just came out this week says that basically we're right where we started in 2000. And it's actually ending up, having people not vote in some states for certain offices. So, for example, there was a county in Florida in 2006 where 18,000 people in one county who actually showed up and voted and got a ballot didn't vote for a particular local office because of the way that the ballot was arranged. So they voted for a more statewide office that was shown prominently on the ballot. I guess right above that, much smaller print, was their local race. They just totally missed it. They blew right by it. This was an electronic voting machine too.
Right, right.
So they just didn't choose anybody. And 18,000 people in this small county ended up not voting. And actually, the guy who ended up winning won by 360 votes.
Because that's, wow.
So who knows who knows what the will of the people was in that particular race. So,
you know what's really sad about that, though? You said that, we're right exactly where we started back in 2000.
Yeah.
Well, except for that $3 billion.
Well, good point.
You know, we're a little poorer.
Touche.
Our third story, this is just a little quick one, but I just thought this number was very interesting. There was a new survey in the Washington Post. It was a Washington Post ABC News study. And they found that a whopping 75% of all Americans now say that they support gays in the military.
75%?
75% say that it should be your sexual identity should play absolutely no part in whether or not you can serve in the nation's Army, Marines, Navy, Air Force. And that's interesting, but more interesting than that, I was fascinated by this, support among conservatives has doubled over the past 15 years.
Wow.
Back in the early 90s, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell first started,
right.
Only 32% of conservatives said that they supported gays serving in the military. Today, that's 64%. So just shows you can come a long way, baby.
Well, I wonder how much that has to do with a change in perception culturally and, versus how much it has to do with our military that's stretched so thin. And unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your political perspective, the potential for more military action, both in Afghanistan, but potentially in a place like Iran.
Yeah. No, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that people got a little more comfortable with people having different sexual identities than they do and realized that just because those two guys over there are in love doesn't mean that you can't still be straight, which, people got really freaked out back in the 80s and stuff.
Right.
And then I think it also, like you said, has to do with this military just being in such trouble that it seems really stupid to keep good, hardworking fighters and soldiers out just because they're not exactly like you.
Sure. Well, so no matter what the reasons are, it probably ends up being a net positive.
Net positive.
So our fourth story for this week, you saw and heard about the New Yorker cover.
Oh, the infamous New Yorker. The Obama satire cover?
Satire cover, exactly, with Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. Basically shown in a cartoon drawing with representing all of the stereotypes that have been sort of thrown at the and incorrect. They're incorrect, obviously, but all of the representations of Obama being anti-patriotic and Obama being a Muslim and what have you. So there was a big firestorm last week in reaction to this cover, both from the McCain campaign and from the Obama campaign. Well, the person who wrote the article for The New Yorker, his name's Ryan Lizza, and he has actually been traveling with the Obama press corps for the last few weeks. And he wrote the article.
Which was a fairly positive article to go along with the cover.
Exactly. And so the article was actually about Obama's roots in Chicago, about sort of his community organizing that he did and dealing with Chicago ward politics. So the article itself was, for the most part, a positive article. About Senator Obama. Well, Senator Obama is going on his trip this week to both the Middle East and to Europe, and they have about 200 members of the press that are going with him. But guess who is not going with
him. Oh, no.
Yeah, the Obama campaign said that they could not find a seat for Ryan Lizza, who's been traveling with them for the past couple weeks, for this big and historic in many ways
right.
trip over to the Middle East and to Europe.
That's a pretty sweet kind of revenge.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't come out and denounce Ryan Lizza, but oops, sorry, your bags got lost, your ticket's gone, your seat's been given away.
Yeah, so they're playing hardball. That sounds like.
I think that's kind of mean.
I think it's kind of mean too. I mean, it's not his fault, and in a lot of ways that his article and that cover didn't really match up. It was a little bit
confusing. Well, I was surprised, actually, when I read the story, because I was expecting it to be about the satire or about all of the misinformation that goes out on, like, you get those emails that
yeah.
say the craziest stuff. But it wasn't. It was about Chicago. And I thought, well, that's still interesting, but it's not what I got hungry for when I saw that cover.
If the goal of the editors at The New Yorker was to get publicity, whether it's negative or
Bingo.
Positive... You are a winner.
And finally, for our fifth story, and this one isn't political, but I just thought it was awesome. there's a new mental disease that they've figured out. And it's a new disease, I guess, for the millennial generation, for all of us YouTube addicts.
Mm.
And basically, it's named after a popular Jim Carrey movie called The Truman Show. And this is called The Truman Show Disorder. And people who are suffering from this are showing up in mental wards and doctor's offices.
Oh, my goodness.
Firmly believing that they are being secretly filmed for a reality show, which doesn't really exist. And and they go about their daily lives as if there are cameras pointed at them. And they're convinced, absolutely convinced, that everybody they know is an actor following a script.
Was there any mention of the number of cases they've identified?
It's not as widespread as I actually would think it would be. How it is, you know, in the morning you're brushing your hair and you pretend that the reality show cameras are there, or maybe you don't. But some people,
I think half of us do.
Some
half
people
of us here do.
Do.
50% of us do probably think that.
That's a good study. So, but it's bad because some of these people, it's not very many, but the ones who have developed it, it's kind of weird. They show up, and one guy was threatening to throw himself off of a building because he was going to climb up to this building because he had been convinced that it was the climax of the show and the woman of his dreams was going to come with roses and hit the last, you know, 6 years of his life were building to this moment. And if the woman wasn't there, he was going to kill himself.
It's terrible to laugh at that, but...
Oh, it's terrible, but it's a very real. People are processing... The media that we're swarmed with every day, you know, the reality shows and the YouTube and Facebook and all of these things that make you the star of your own blogs or television shows, and they're taking it just to that next level and seeing them when they're not there.
Okay, but let's be perfectly honest about it. These people probably weren't mentally healthy.
Oh, right.
Before a reality TV show. So reality TV and what we're putting out there right now is, I mean, I don't know, what's the word, a catalyst or a trigger
uh-huh.
for obviously mental illness that was already present.
Well, and also, you know, thinking that you're Napoleon or Elvis is just so 2006.
For more about these stories and many more like it, check it out at miccheckradio.org. Stick around. John Norris coming up to talk with us about Sedan.
This is Christy Harvey. Over the past 5.5 years, a government-backed militia in Sudan, known as the Janjaweed, has brutalized the nation with a systematic, deliberate strategy of rape, murder, and terror in the region of Darfur. According to the UN, some 300,000 people have been murdered and 2.5 million people have been driven from their homes. Those left have been raped, maimed, and terrorized, and today are out of food, medical supplies, and hope. Last week, the head of the International Criminal Court charged Sudanese President al-Bashir with masterminding this genocide. He denied everything. China jumped in to defend Sudan, and although there wasn't a dry eye in the House when America was transfixed by Don Cheadle in Hotel Rwanda a couple of years ago, the United States has been sitting by and doing, well, not too much of anything. Why? For the answer to that question, today we'll talk to John Norris, head of the Enough Project to Stop Genocide. Hi, John. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So first of all, if you could just give us an overview of what's actually happening in Sudan right now. It seems as if news coverage of the tragedy in Darfur ebbs and flows a little bit. There's a lot of news and then not quite so much news. And I know it can be hard to keep track. What's actually going on?
Sure. This was a big news week for Sudan. And the biggest news of Sudan actually didn't come from Sudan itself, but it came from The Hague this week, where the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court called for an arrest warrant to be issued against the president of Sudan, President Bashir, on charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, alleging that the president of Sudan has directly orchestrated the tragedy in Darfur. And obviously, this is a very major development and comes at a sensitive time.
How was that news taken on the ground in Sudan?
Well, everybody kind of held their breath a little bit, and I think it's a real crossroads for the international community and for the government of Sudan. I think there are concerns that perhaps the Sudanese government will use this as an excuse to make things worse, start targeting humanitarian groups, go after the UN force on the ground more aggressively. There's already been a number of deaths already in recent weeks, and take a all-in-all more confrontational approach to the situation in Darfur. But I don't think they're necessarily going to do that. And I think the situation this week was surprisingly calm. I think in some ways the prosecutor has really changed the dynamic. And now people are trying to figure out exactly what that means and where the process is going to go from now.
Two questions for you, John, connected to the ICC developments this past week. The first is, do you think that the ICC judgment was a true one and a fair one? Is the president the mastermind behind the genocide that's going on in Darfur? Or do you think that they were overreaching to make a point?
I think there's merits to the charges. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the three-judge panel to whom the prosecutor has presented his request will weigh in on the evidence and make their own determination. But I think for everybody who's been involved in Sudan and in Darfur over the last 5 years, the humanitarians on the ground, the diplomats, the policymakers, the journalists, it's always been abundantly clear that the Janjaweed militias that have done so much to terrorize the population, resulting in more than 300,000 deaths, 2 million people being driven from their homes, were working hand in glove with the Sudanese military and intelligence services. There's been air support for Janjaweed militias, and obviously the Janjaweed don't have an air force, but the government of Sudan does. And clearly this is consistent with the government's general policy of a divide-and-conquer approach to dealing with rebellions and problems in the hinterland. And I think there is abundant evidence that the government of Sudan has directly orchestrated the tragedy in Darfur.
To go along with that, just for some listeners who may not be up on what is happening in Darfur, if you could give us just a Sudan 101. Why is this genocide happening? What was the impetus? And what are the different sides? Who are the Janjaweed?
Sure. The Janjaweed is a proxy militia that's been stood up by the government of Sudan. There was a fairly low-level retrograde insurgency that broke out in western Sudan in the Darfur region about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as we'd seen in earlier conflicts in southern Sudan, the government of Sudan was quick to arm neighboring villagers, to arm different groups usually based on ethnicity, and to really kind of pour gasoline on some of the natural social divisions that already exist in a place as big and complex as Sudan. And basically what we've seen since that period of 2003 is real practical and concerted effort to depopulate the African population in Darfur and in western Sudan. Driving out huge numbers of people into Chad, abroad, other people displaced within Sudan. And that tragedy continues unabated today.
That's one of my questions. The second follow-up question I had to what we were talking about is, this has been going on 5.5 years, and there has been, the UN has gotten involved, and the U.S. has gotten involved in various ways, and you've got the African Union, and now the ICC has come forward, the International Criminal Court has come forward with these charges. Does the ICC have the teeth that some of these other groups seem to be lacking to actually affect change in Sudan?
Well, I think the international community as a whole has as much teeth or as few teeth as it chooses to use. The UN is made up of its member states, and if its member states don't have the political will to push for change, it doesn't happen.
Are you talking about China there?
Well, China, Russia, United States, European Union, member states clearly haven't made Sudan as much of a priority as they should. And certainly China, which gets an awful lot of its oil supply from Sudan these days, has often acted rather unfortunately like the chief defense lawyer for the Sudanese government.
Right.
But an awful lot of what we've seen to date has been the fact that the UN and member states have often issued tough statements, but they haven't been followed up on. And I think the move by the chief prosecutor in the International Criminal Court is really a useful one, because I think the government of Sudan will keep raping, pillaging, and terrorizing its own people until there's some cost for its actions. And I think the court has taken a very useful step forward as far as that goes.
How about the U.S.? It always really struck me that everyone came out of Hotel Rwanda weeping, and how could we have ignored that back in the 90s, and then walked right by news kiosks that had big headlines saying, happening right now in Sudan. Why do you think that this tragedy has been ignored to the point that it has? I mean, there has been a lot of attention for it, but I don't know. To me, it just doesn't seem like it's really gone anywhere to really put our foot down and get involved in a way that would stop what's happening in Darfur.
I think the U.S. has taken a reasonably tough rhetorical position over the last 5 years. President Bush was out there fairly early on calling this a genocide in language that among a bunch of other states were frankly uncomfortable using, and even some humanitarian groups had been reluctant to use.
Right.
And I think they have put it reasonably high as a priority. But I think the international community has also sensed the United States is not willing to lend a decisive hand in these matters, that it isn't entirely serious about implementing sanctions. It has been reluctant to consider the use of military force. It has been slow to lend air assets and other resources to the UN mission on the ground. And I think there's an awful lot of cases we saw in Yugoslavia in the 1990s where the international community kind of waits and sees what the United States is going to do. And they'll listen to our rhetoric, and they'll listen to what we say at the UN and elsewhere, Washington, and European capitals. But until we are actually willing to lead and take action on the ground, people will say, well, they're talking about it, but they're not really serious about it. Because if they were serious, those would be U.S. helicopters assisting the UN mission. They would be implementing the sanctions. They would be going after these people. So I think to date, the rhetoric hasn't quite lived up to the reality.
Sticks and stones can break their bones, but words won't really hurt them.
And sadly, the Sudanese government is very cognizant of this fact. They're very good at playing internationals off against each other. They're very good at testing the fence. They'll dig their heels in, and then when it looks like the international community might actually take some tough action, they'll make a few concessions, then they'll roll them back when the attention turns somewhere else 2 weeks later.
This is Christy Harvey. You're listening to The Progressive Beat, and I'm talking to John Norris from the Enough Campaign. And why do you think it is that we're not doing what needs to be done? Is it, as some people have said, because our military is stretched so thin with the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Or is it an economic factor that we don't want to anger some of our friends who are also friends with Sudan, like China and Russia? Or is that just too simplified and you really can't boil down why we haven't gotten involved?
No, it's all of those things. I think the war in Iraq has tied up an awful lot of troops, an awful lot of resources, blood and treasure, as it were, the situation in Afghanistan. And I think for a lot of people looking at perhaps some kind of humanitarian intervention in another state, a large state, sprawling geography, an Islamic state, those are very delicate, tough questions. And I think there's also a sense that the administration right now is probably feeling a little bit overwhelmed, that there's problems in the banking sector, there's problems with mortgages, there's problems in Baghdad, there's problems in Kabul. And as much as every administration would like to do everything, there is a finite amount of time and energy and resources. And I think there has been that sense of profound distraction. And I think there's also been a lot of queasiness on both sides of the political spectrum, in that some of the people who would be the most logical champions of some kind of humanitarian intervention, or perhaps even a threat of the use of force, on the left side of the spectrum, are so uncomfortable with what happened in Iraq that they aren't necessarily sure they want to see it replicated in Sudan. And some of those people on the right who have always been very skeptical of the idea of humanitarian intervention, have used some of that language and some of that exact same language to defend their course of action in the invasion of Iraq and kind of where we are today. So it is very uneasy bedfellows right now. And I think the best hope we have for changing America's leadership on this is the fact that there are millions of Americans who've been attracted to taking action in Darfur, a very broad, nonpartisan, bipartisan coalition of different groups, of students, of church groups, of synagogues, of young, old, left, right, center. And I think that really is our greatest hope for changing our leadership and leading from below.
Well, and I think a lot of this is going to heat up in the next month or so with the Olympics. And there has been a push by such people as Mia Farrow and Steven Spielberg to call these the Genocide Olympics. And people were putting a lot of pressure, especially on President Bush, not to attend the Olympics. So it's good in the fact that it's going to bring more attention to this. But what did you think of President Bush's decision to attend the Olympics? Is that a good one, a bad one, or not really relevant to the situation?
Well, I think in some ways probably more important than whether President Bush attends the games or not is ultimately where China sees itself on the world stage. And I think if we look at where China is right now, it's hard not to reach the conclusion that it is every unsavory government's best friend, that if we look at Zimbabwe, if we look at Sudan, if we look at Burma, and the list goes on, frankly.
China actually came out after the ICC decision last week and said that they condemned that decision. They attacked the ICC for bringing charges against Sudan's president, which I found shocking that they would actually get that involved in the situation. I thought they were doing backroom stuff.
A week after they'd moved quite energetically to block sanctions against Zimbabwe for President Mugabe's actions. And I think China is, in some senses, being quite naive and not understanding that if they want to be a great economic power, if they want to play a real role on the world stage, they can't be seen as defending every tin pot tyrant and dictator around the globe, that will simply hurt their image. It will bring more castigation from every quarter. And at the point when information actually penetrates deeply enough into Chinese society, I think it will actually create real unhappiness among average Chinese about their leadership and the country, the direction their country is going in.
So, John Norris, let's skip ahead a little bit. It's January 20th, 2009. Either President Obama or President McCain comes to you and says, okay, you have now become our emissary of what to do in Sudan. What do we do first? What is the absolute first step we take, and where do we go? It's in your hands. What would you advise?
Yeah, I think both candidates have done a pretty good job of saying that they will take this issue seriously and placing it reasonably high on their agenda. And I think everybody should be happy that both of them see this as not only a moral issue, but a serious strategic issue to be dealt with a potential to destabilize a very large chunk of Africa. So I think they're both to be congratulated for that. I think one of the things that we've learned over the last decade and even before that is that we need to deal with Sudan comprehensively. The situation in Darfur is not unrelated to what's going on in southern Sudan. And basically, we've got a government in Sudan that has always kept a disproportionate amount of power in the center and shunted off the rest of the country and kind of divided groups against each other. And I think until we deal with that very fundamental problem, Sudan isn't going to get fixed. And we could fix the situation in Darfur, then have something else pop up in eastern Sudan.
Right.
There's supposed to be a national election next year, not long after the next president is inaugurated. So I'm sure they will be reaching out to their own advisors and asking what's to be done. But there is a real danger because the government of Sudan has not respected an earlier peace agreement with southern Sudan after a lengthy and very deadly war with the south. And I think if they do not seriously address that issue, there's real risk that Sudan itself as a state could move towards some kind of splintering.
Right.
And not just a neat and tidy north-south division, but a conflict that would spread to more and more quarters. So I think this does need to be very high on the radar for the next president. And they need to look at it in a very holistic sense of how power and how governance actually work in Sudan, rather than simply thinking that they can fix Sudan piece by piece, neighborhood by neighborhood.
John Norris from the Enough Campaign, thank you very much. And this is Christy Harvey with Progressive Beat.
Now it's time for a little trivia quiz. Play along in your car, take bets around the office, whatever you want to do, then stick around and later in the show, we'll answer the question for you. So here's today's question. Which presidential campaign had its volunteers roll giant buckskin balls from town to town with its campaign slogan on the side? We'll give you this one in multiple choice because it's kind of tough. Is it A, William Henry Harrison, B, John Breckinridge, C, Bill Clinton, or is it D, none of the above? Stick around and we'll give you the answer later on in the show.
Grab your highlighter and brew a pot of tea. It's time for Progressive Book Club. Up this week, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington by author and my friend, David Sirota. Welcome, David. So, David, why this book and why right now?
Well, because the country's really, pissed off. And I went and I looked at how people are organizing around their anger. And what that organization will really mean in our upcoming election and beyond. I think we're at an uprising moment right now, which, as I define in the book, it means that we're not really at a moment yet of a full-fledged or a number of full-fledged social movements. Although we're not also at a moment of disengagement, obviously, we're at that middle ground, that primordial soup. And the question is whether the amoeba, if you will, will climb out of the primordial soup and become something real. Are we going to get out of the anger about health care? Are we going to get a universal health care system? Out of the anger about the war, are we going to get a stop to the war, et
right.
cetera, et cetera? That's the question that I asked.
Well, I thought it was so interesting in the book, the way you found all of these seemingly completely disparate groups, you know, groups that couldn't even be in the same room for a cocktail party together without coming to blows. And yet you were able to weave these groups together and show that they actually do have some commonalities, even if it just is that anger.
Right. It's the commonality is the impulse. People are very, very angry at the government. They think that the government is not just incompetent, but is actually actively and quite competently contributing to and creating the economic crises that we face.
Do you think that's an overtly political thing? Do you think it's a partisan issue? Is this a people are mad at Republicans, or do you think they're mad at government in general?
No, I think that they see the government as contributing to and creating the crises we face, and I think that it's bipartisan. I think that people know that the war was started by both Democrats and Republicans, and that the government continues that war through both Democrats and Republicans. I think people know that the job outsourcing and wage cutting crisis is a product of trade deals, NAFTAs, that both Republicans and Democrats have pushed. I think people know, even on the issue of immigration, even the Minutemen will tell you that they think that the current policy on immigration, the current situation on immigration, is because of a government that's bought off by big money interests.
Right.
And I think that they're right. Now, I disagree with their prescription, with their quote-unquote solution to the immigration situation. But the point is that at least, as you said, at the beginning, the impulse of all these groups on both the right and the left is very, very similar.
Well, the urge for these groups to come together, I think, and move forward is a very basic one and really harkens back to the old populism way of doing things. Do you think that this is really just sort of a newfangled populist notion?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we have lived through an era now of populism in the past.
Right.
In the 80s and the 90s. And I think populism always exists. The right has created cultural populism. They've made the us versus them competition a competition, or they've pitched it as ethnicity versus ethnicity, geography versus geography, race versus race. And now you're seeing the rise, I think, of economic populism to challenge that, where both people on both the right and left say and believe that the us versus them is the have-nots versus the haves.
So what do we do? When you were on, I saw you on Colbert, by the way. That was hysterical. Was that fun to do?
It's fun in retrospect. I felt like I during it, it was, I would say, excruciating.
I can't imagine that, like, minute before you go on air with Stephen Colbert. That must be crazy. But you were talking on there, or trying to, about needing vehicles for a movement, needing vehicles for people to join together and actually get somewhere on all of these issues. For example, healthcare. What are these vehicles, and where can I get one?
Well, I
promise it'll be a hybrid.
Yeah, right. What I was encouraging people to do is to see politicians and parties and elections as one of many vehicles. That parties and politicians and elections are not the ends, but they're the means. And that if we think that a party or a politician or an election is the ends and not the means, then we're going to be very disappointed. We're not going to get the change that we want. If we think that electing whoever's running for president now, if it's McCain or Obama, whoever your candidate is, if you think electing that person means you're going to get automatically going to get change, you're crazy. That's not the way politics works, not the way power works. We need to keep the pressure on. In fact, I would say that all the election really is a potential opportunity for change.
Mm-hmm.
But if the pressure doesn't stay on, there will not be that change.
And do you need pressure on the candidate? Do you need pressure on politicians in Congress? And
I
guess the big question is, how do you apply pressure, though, if you're broke? You know, there's so much big money in elections now and big money in Congress with lobbyists and fundraisers and things like that. How does someone like me, who's barely making it to the end of the month, how do I get that pressure?
Well, what I would say is that there's a strange paradox that's gone on. That as mass media and television has come to really, really, truly dominate politics, as it's gotten so big, and you have 400 channels on your cable, you've got email, you've got the internet, you've got YouTube, you've got radio. As there's been so much more noise in the political process, in fact, the premium has gone back to interpersonal politics.
Mm-hmm.
and connecting with your neighbor, connecting with your community. I mean, you know this. If you hear about a movie on television, you're lucky to find that to see an ad. But you'll go out and see the movie if your friend tells you, hey, that movie's pretty good.
Right.
So in other words, what I'm saying is that sure, money's always going to be a power in politics, but people power. Through the internet, through local community organizing, through civic groups, this has actually become more powerful because there's so much of that media big money noise.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this around to new media, because I'm going to ask you to give away some of your secrets. This is a true story. I was in a meeting up on the Hill with a bunch of, you know, the lib types, and they're talking about this thing they're going to put together. And one of them actually said, what we need to do is, you know, like David Sirota did with the uprising. We need to get a big internet presence. And it just made me, I was like, I know that guy. But so many people have tried to harness the power of the internet, of Facebook and MySpace and YouTube and all of these things. And so many people are doing it really poorly.
Mm-hmm.
How would you suggest that, I mean, look at the candidates, for example. You know, John McCain says he knows that there is an internet, and that is a big step forward, but he's, you know, not taking it by storm like you did with your book. Obama really hasn't done much better. The one guy who really did a good job with the internet this time around was Mike Gravel with those crazy videos. How would you suggest or advise people who want to start a movement of their own using new media to proceed?
Well, what I would say is that I think that the best model is the Facebook model and the social networking model. That you have to, that organizations and organizers have to follow what Saul Alinsky, the great organizer, said, is that the goal of any organizing should be to give people the most power as possible, trusting that they'll do the right thing. And so, to me, the social networking component of the internet is really where it's at. In other words, social networking, you give people the ability to self-organize. So we should be looking at all the tools of self-organization. You can start a Facebook group, for just one example,
mm-hmm.
where you invite other people to join the group around a common cause, and you give people the ability to use the tools of that group. It's not a top-down situation. We have now blog sites out there where you can have your own diary on a bigger blog site. So what I'm saying is that try to use all of the tools when you're on the internet that empower people to participate. If you give people ownership over your cause, over your organization, they're more likely to engage in that organization and drive their friends to that organization.
But what about the fear then that you lose the control? I actually talked about blogs to some lawmakers on the Hill last year, and one congressman who shall remain nameless came up after and started jabbing his finger into the middle of my chest going, "I'm not going to blog. People like to hear what I say on my letterhead." And I thought,
That's the debate, right? I mean, do you give up control or not? What I would say is that democracy, small d democracy, is a radical concept precisely because you have to give up control. But if you give up control, it's that, what's that old adage? You know, if you set it free,
if you love something, set it free. Isn't that a Sting song too? Isn't that the Police?
It probably is. but I guess the paraphrase on it is that if you want something to be great, you have to set it free, because you have to create the idea that people feel ownership over something. When you feel ownership over something, you're more likely to ask your friends to participate. You're more likely to put your heart and soul into it.
David Sirota, author of the new book, The Uprising, thanks for joining us today on The Progressive Beat.
Thanks, Christy.
I remember first learning what had happened in Memphis on the 4th of April, 1968, feeling just as everyone else did back home, only perhaps even more uncertain and alarmed for my country in the darkness that was then enclosed around me and my fellow prisoners of war. The enemy had correctly calculated that the news of Dr. King's death would deeply wound morale. Yet how differently it all turned out. And if they had been the more reflective kind, our enemies would have understood that the cause of Dr. King was bigger than any one man and could not be stopped by force of violence.
That was John McCain last week speaking in front of the NAACP. And with us now on the Progressive Beat, we have Daniela Leger, who is the Vice President for Communications at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Daniela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What's ironic about that, and that was towards the end of his speech, it was about a 20-minute or so speech, and he didn't mention Martin Luther King Jr. until the very end of the speech. And what's interesting is that only a couple months ago, he got a lot of flack for addressing Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when back in 1983, as a congressman, he actually voted against making that a federal holiday. So, evoking Martin Luther King deservingly so in his speech, is it interesting to you that he didn't address what he got so much criticism for only a couple months ago?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, and I was one of those people who was giving him a lot of criticism for his vote back in 1983. I think it would have been a good place for him to, you know, further explain why he voted the way he did, instead of the excuse that he has given in the past, was that, you know, that was a long time ago, and he didn't realize the importance of Martin Luther King to the country. In 1983, I'm pretty sure people realize exactly how important he was to this country, so there really is no excuse for that vote.
And last year, Senator McCain respectfully declined an invitation to speak in front of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1996, funny enough, he was advising Senator Bob Dole and advised him not to go to speak in front of the NAACP when he was running, because he said, I think that the quote was that he would basically feel out of place.
Right.
So do you think that this was something that, at least politically, he absolutely had to do? Or do you think he could have gotten away with not going?
Well, I think he could have gotten away without going because other Republican presidential candidates have not gone before. Also, you know, George Bush didn't go in 2004. I believe he went in 2000. But, you know, if he's serious about being a different kind of Republican, then I think he had to go for that reason. And he's trying to find anything that he can to separate himself from George Bush. So this was probably one of those ways he thought he could say, I'm not like Bush, I'm here, and I'm talking to you.
Do you think that he successfully sort of braved this hostile crowd, or what people in the press were calling a hostile crowd, which is probably unfair in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, they're not hostile. Granted, a lot of them were Obama supporters. But, you know, it's more the less the Republican Party engages and talks to the African-American community, the more that this sort of thing is going to be, oh, he's like doing this huge thing by going and speaking to the African-American community. Well, you know, African-Americans are Americans. And so right. Any candidate who's running for office should speak to all Americans.
The way that Senator McCain started out his speech, it was almost as if he conceded that the room was already for Senator Obama. So in doing that, does he basically sort of render the trip to talk in front of the NAACP obsolete? I mean, is the purpose not to go there to try to convince the members in the NAACP in the room that that he is a viable candidate for them to choose?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was either trying to be cute or just trying to make a joke with the audience, but he should have gone and said, you know, he could have said nice things about Obama, that's fine, but he should never concede that everybody in that room was going to support Obama. You know, everyone wants to hear what John McCain is going to do on the economy, what he's going to do for health care. And if he went forward and actually started from the beginning and said, I'm here and I'm here to fight for your
right.
vote, that probably would have garnered him a little more respect from that audience.
Absolutely. The one area in particular where he, at least gauging success of the speech by applause, he got a good reception was when he talked about education reform and how important it is. And, you know, when the NAACP gives grades to candidates on what their overall platform is, he received an F recently in their most recent grades in education policy, obviously, is an important part of that. And Senator McCain talked about it and framed it as being in favor of school choice, which some people would call vouchers.
Right.
In the African American community, and it got a good reception in that room when he talked about it. Is that one area that he may be able to make inroads? And are there others that he left out?
You know, I don't know how many. I don't know that vouchers alone is enough to move the African American community. I do think that is kind of like the go-to topic for Republicans when they're trying to reach out to the Black community. You know, I think he could have talked more about, you know, the economy. He could have talked more about rising health care. He could have talked more. See, he could have talked more about things that Republicans don't like to talk about, like
right.
what's the government doing to help these families who've been left behind in this economy? What is he doing about foreclosures? Because unfortunately for him, he's on the wrong side of those issues. So I think, you know, Republicans, they have a few couple areas where they feel like, okay, this is safe, this is good for me to talk about.
Right.
But it's not enough. I mean, there are a whole lot of issues. Education is a very important issue, but you know, vouchers is something that, you know, can maybe take care of a small part of that problem. And he doesn't address the totality, the systematic problem of the public education system in this country. Vouchers isn't going to solve that problem alone.
Well, and isn't that actually where Senator McCain needs to sort of branch out, but not just to the African-American community, although they may be disproportionately affected by the problems in the economy or failing public schools? He needs to reach out on those issues to any number of different demographic groups.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think he's sort of getting the message now, and I think he feels like gas prices might be his way in to get to people to talk about his economic
right.
plan and try and hide the fact that his economic plan generously favors the wealthy, and he gives a $4 billion corporate tax break to the oil companies. So, you know, I think he's getting the message that he needs to connect better on the economy with all Americans, and I think he sees gas prices as a way to do that. I don't know that it's succeeding.
I want to read a line from the very end of the speech, and something that I kind of found interesting, and you sort of have to read between the lines. McCain said, I am a candidate for president who seeks your vote and hopes to earn it, but whether or not I win your support, I need your goodwill and counsel. The next sentence, then, he goes on to say, and if I win, I need it even more so. And so the way that I read that, I thought it was an interesting way of putting it, that, you know, I could use your help now, but if I win, I need it even more. And so it seemed to me that he actually wasn't even appealing to the people in the room and the African-American community for their vote in November necessarily. It's almost like, again, he's sort of giving that to Senator Obama. He's saying that he needs their support if he wins, obviously with a different coalition in some respects. Do you think that that's a smart play?
No, I always think it's bad when politicians look past the election. Don't look past the election. You have
right.
to win first. I think he could have talked more about earning their vote and what he was going to do to earn their vote and how he wanted to work with these communities up until the election to get his message out. You know, I think it's odd that he couched it that way.
And then finally, I think that when the press reports stories like this, they basically end up, in some respects, pigeonholing the African-American community. The people who are in that room at the NAACP automatically then in these stories become a complete and clear representation of the African-American community. How much different are the concerns of the African-American community from every other American? I mean, is it unfortunate that we are writing stories and addressing it in this way, where it's almost as if we're allowing the press to bunch the African American community sort of on the side, and you know, McCain and Obama have to go and address the NAACP, and then they check off that box, the African American community box. But isn't it true though that for the most part, the concerns of the African American community, especially right now, are the same as everybody else?
Yeah, that's true, and you know. I don't know that it's ever going to change. The media likes to play constituent politics, and unfortunately the parties play along into that. So there's always going to be, oh, this week McCain is courting Hispanic voters, this week they're courting Jewish voters, you know, this week it's women voters. So there's always going to be that sort of delineation. But I do think that the African-American community, just like the white community, is not a monolith, and there are many different opinions and many different views. And yes, there are black Republicans and there are black independents, and you know, it's at a candidate's peril that they treat the, you know, African American community as a voting bloc. And I know that Senator Obama enjoys a very, you know, high percentage of the African American vote, but I'd like to remind people that a year ago Senator Clinton enjoyed the majority of African American vote. You know, candidates
right,
have to
right.
prove that they deserve the vote no matter what color they are.
And the difference in reception that Senator Obama gets at an NAACP meeting when he does a speech versus the reception that Senator McCain gets, it's almost as if the NAACP trying to represent African Americans who, you know, as you explain, have varied ideological points of view. It's almost as if, wouldn't you say, that they need to do their job and open up that forum, give an equal reception to both candidates?
Well, they can't control the members in their room. You know, they're going to
sure.
react how they're going to react. And I think that the leaders on stage were, you know, as equally enthusiastic and respectful of McCain
Absolutely.
As they were of Obama. And that's what's important. And I think sometimes in the past that may not have been the case. But, you know, I think they appreciated the fact that he came knowing it was going to be a quote-unquote hostile audience. So
It's difficult to sort of put on the back burner the historical nature of the Obama campaign. I mean,
right.
it's just difficult to do. Daniela Gibbs Leger, thanks so much. Vice President of Communications at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. It will be interesting to see how things shape up.
It will indeed. Thanks for having me.
Trivia time. Today's question, in case you missed it, was about which presidential campaigner had his volunteers push giant balls made of buckskin and painted with his campaign slogans up and down and up and down the streets of the towns in which he was giving speeches. Did you figure it out or did you give up? The answer is in 1840, supporters of William Henry Harrison rolled these monstrous balls up and down the streets of town, painted with campaign slogans like Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Tippecanoe obviously was the battle in which William Henry Harrison had been a hero. And it's basically the 19th century equivalent of those giant billboard trucks that drive up and down the strip in Las Vegas today. Interesting fact, though, from this campaign tactic of rolling these giant buckskin balls around in town, we today have the expression, keep the ball rolling. And that's this week's trivia question. And that's this week's show. Join us next week for more Paparazzi Politics, where we bring you the top political issues facing the country, the candidates, and you on the Progressive Beat. I'm Christy Harvey. Thanks for joining us.